Blog Talk Radio.
Quiet, please. Welcome to Rex Sykes Movie Beat Conversations with Filmmakers, where we discuss everything film and television. Here on Movie Beat, you'll learn what to do and what not to do when it comes to making movies and TV. And we will talk to everyone behind the scenes and in front of the camera. And I'll provide you with the guests and the information you're going to want to have, whether you're a filmmaker or a fan. And so now let's move behind the scenes here at Movie Beat. My guest today is producer, writer, actor Lenore Andriel and her producing partner, executive producer Steve Doucette, who also co-wrote Yellow Rock, a movie now available that you can see, and I encourage you to do so. We'll talk more about both these very fascinating people and the movie in just a moment. Let me say that we are live, and the official web address is rexsykes.com. That's my name. I'm your host. It's rexsikes.com. All of these interviews are conducted live and then recorded live and then archived at rexsikes.com in the interviews blog page. So just go to rexsikes.com, go to interviews, find my guest by name, and you can listen live and or archived. If you're listening live, you can join us in the chat room, and we encourage everyone to do that. That's awesome. Also, whether you're listening live or archived, do us this favor. Reach out, email someone, talk to someone across the room, phone them, grab someone, and ask them to join you in listening. Let them know that the show is available and that they can listen to it either with you live or by themselves, or they can listen to it archived, the recorded show. And also, please leave comments both during the show at the player and or after the show once it's done. You can do that again, live or recorded. We really appreciate the comments, and we really appreciate you reaching out to others, because it helps extend our reach to other people out there in the world who may not know about the show, may not have had the opportunity to hear my guests speak before. And when you leave a comment, when you rate and review the show at the podcast, because all these shows are available at iTunes as a free podcast, when you rate and review the show there, when you leave comments and when you share the show, it extends the reach of our show to other filmmakers and fans, makes us obviously much more available to them, and we appreciate it so much when you do. I appreciate all the support and all the love already from people who tweet and retweet and who Facebook the show and who share it to their walls and share it with their friends. You guys are great. All right, well, enough about all that. Let me tell you about my guest today. Sorry for the big there. But Lenore Andriel is an actor, and Steve Doucette together wrote and produced Yellow Rock, starring Michael Biehn and James Russo and Andriel. Andriel's first starring role was with Bo Svenson in Blood Brothers, and she had leads in award-winning indie films including Childhood with Tara Fitzgerald, Midnight Witness with Max Caulfield, and the tearjerker indie Desperate Measures. She also starred opposite the likes of Paul Rudd, Dennis Haysbert, Paul Johansson, and Miguel Ferrer. In both films and television, she portrays several lead characters in the world of Warcraft. Her list of gaming characters for Blizzard includes Ysera, Mothership, Archival System, and more. She's an avid traveler, passionate about the environment, and a consummate horsewoman. And in Yellow Rock, she portrayed the strong female lead, Dr. Sarah Taylor. Now, she also rides the horse, and that for me, I'm an avid horseman, so I love that. This is cool. All right, now Steve Doucette and her wrote this film, and this is their first venture as filmmakers, and it paid off with her winning a coveted Best Actress Award, Best Screenplay, shared with, of course, co-writer Steve, and Best Picture multiple times, and Best Producer before the film had ever been released. Steve Doucette was at one time a stand-up comedian who worked with the likes of Drew Carey, Soupy Sales, and The Unknown Comic, some of the best comedy clubs in the country. And with Doucette's current behind-the-scenes business acumen, he and Andriel were able to attract the prestigious entertainment law firm of Redner & Geig and their producer rep at the firm, Nur Ahmed, brokered the worldwide distribution deals for them. And together, they're working on their next project with the development of their new company, Enlightenment Films. All right. So I want to welcome both Steve and Lenore to the show today. Hi, how are you doing? Lenore, are you there?
I'm here, Rex. Good morning to you.
Good morning. And Steve, are you there as well?
I'm here. Good morning to you, Rex.
All right, good morning. Well, this is exciting. I'm glad to have you both on the show. I've been lucky. I've seen the movie. Actually, I've seen it now a couple of times. So, and I'm going to see it again.
We love to hear that.
Yeah, no, it's very cool. So let me ask you right out of the gate, just how did you both meet? And then from that, how did you become writing and producing partners?
Well, oddly enough, I was actually, you know, helping a girl try and find her stray cat.
That was me, Rex.
About 12 o'clock at night. I was much more interested in Lenore than I was in the cat, but that's
here
a whole other story.
And that started a wonderful partnership and friendship, and we've been, oh, God, it's been at least a good 10 years. And one thing led to another, and here we are after having done Yellow Rock together, and we hope to do many more in the future, too.
Awesome, awesome. And you not only produced together, and
mm-hmm.
Steve taking the executive producer role, you taking a creative producer role,
yeah.
But you also wrote together.
Yes. We actually had an idea to do a web series, and there were a lot of similarities, et cetera, and Steve and I were going to sort of write this together and kind of put my contacts in the business together, just sort of do a nice little pilot and see where we would go with that. And in that process, we wound up realizing, you know what, it's actually a lot better for the money that Steve was going to put in at the time to do a pilot for a web series. Let's just do an indie film. And that shifted everything greatly. Once we decided to then do it as an indie film, we started to do some research and we started to talk, and it was actually a present-day film. And in the creative process of talking and discussing about my character and some of the other Native American characters, Steve came up with the idea and said, why don't we just do this as a Western? Why don't we do it as a period piece? Number one, creatively, it would completely open the door for us with a plethora of visual eye candy and the dirtiness and grittiness of the Old West. But it would also save us a lot of money, because when you're doing a present-day film, now you've got cars and exteriors, and it actually would wind up being a lot more. And we were off and running, and we had no idea that Westerns were actually going to be hot, right, Steve?
Absolutely. We kind of fell into that. It was a happy accident, because as soon as we started developing it, all the other cowboy movies, you know, started coming to the forefront, whether it was, you know, Cowboys,
wow,
Aliens, True Grit. So our timing was great, you know, as far as, you know, being in that, you know, in that curve to where you want to be in a genre that we hope is making a comeback now. I think, you know, a lot of people like ourselves grew up with Westerns, and we'd like to see it come back.
Well, there's something, I mean, you know, the Western, just the scenery alone, just when you're out, you know, on a trail with horses and you see the backgrounds, that, I think, in and of itself has an awesome appeal. Then when you've got a good movie and a good cast of characters and great action, I think it just fits all together really well. And I think you did that really, really well with Yellow Rock.
Thank you, Rex. It was an experience like no other. I mean, for Steve, this was kind of his second foray into filmmaking, and we can talk about that later. But it certainly wasn't my first time, but it was my first time doing a Western, and it's not like anything else. It's magical. It's exhilarating. It's exceedingly difficult. People don't realize when you say a Western how much actually gets involved with the minutiae on the overall canvas of it. Bringing in the beauty and the outdoors is fantastic, but then you have to worry about all the other issues, not the least of which having a lot of actors, myself included, galloping on horseback, through this rough terrain and shooting guns and all of the aspects that entails.
Well, I think it's just much harder to do, you pointed out, maybe it's cheaper to do the Western because we don't have the cars and everything else, but I think it's just much harder to do a Western because when you have the attention to detail and making it come off as if it were, 100 years ago or more, you've got all of the horses and the wildlife and the wrangling of just that and trying to hit marks and the terrain and making the cast believable cowboys and Indians, the whole thing. I mean, it to me, I think it's incredibly ambitious to have your first producing venture be a Western.
It really was, right, Steve?
And that's what most people told us, what we were trying to do was extremely ambitious and almost rolling their eyes at us.
I can imagine.
Because it really is. You have multiple locations, and you have an extremely challenging schedule as well because, this is a low-budget, independent film. So everybody is really on the go. You only have time to do, most of the time, just one take. And so we
one
had
to
a,
two, yeah.
Yeah, and so thank God we had a great cast that was able to pull that off, and director and DP. It is really quite involved. I had been on set, as an AD, as an assistant director on sets before, but being in charge of everything and responsible for everyone, and especially their safety, as we're doing these stunts, is really important, and that'll get your stomach turning.
Oh, I bet. I want to come back to that in a few moments, hopefully in today's show too, about the stunts and everything that goes on. But,
yeah.
But did I hear you correctly? Did you say that your shot ratio was like 1-to-1? You had one take, or that much of the time because of a stunt or something, you had one take?
Yeah, we had two cameras. This was a two-camera shoot, thank God, which that helped enormously. Obviously, you're getting your wide shots at the same time that, camera on camera B or camera A, you're doing your close-ups either way. And so that does absolutely help. And granted, the director is under enormous pressure because he has to know when to do his one or two takes. I, as the female lead, most of the time got one to two takes. And I'd sit there, and I'm used to doing that a lot by doing independent films. But Steve knew I would get like a little upset and look at him like, wait a minute, I want another take, and you can answer that.
Yeah. Well, our director Nick is saying, I got what I wanted. She nailed it, And what's really interesting about it too is that a lot of the dialogues, there was one or two takes, but what was interesting was the action scenes. That's where you had to do two or three or takes. And so even the simplest thing where somebody might be falling down might look like a stunt. But if they have to do it three and four times, it starts to beat you up.
Oh, well, yeah, very much so. Just to clarify, were you shooting on film? Is that why? Or was it the amount of days that you had, in terms of was it the cost of raw stock or was it the amount of time you had to shoot that you had the narrow shot ratio?
We actually shot this digitally on two RED cameras, which I highly recommend to any independent filmmakers, and I'll tell you why. You have so much more latitude in post to fix but a lot of the mistakes or a lot of the aspects that maybe you didn't get, i.e. maybe you didn't get enough coverage. Now you can take it from the picture ratio and actually push in by 200 times and actually cheat it and get your close-up. It also helps with coloring in post, et cetera. So there are many wonderful reasons why, if you're going to do independent, it's much more cost-effective, and you get a great quality to it, for sure. The second aspect of that was we wrote an exceedingly ambitious script. I like to write with a lot of detail in terms of the description to give the director a lot of visuals of how that scene looks. And then, of course, he can go in and do what he wants. But it was a very ambitious script, and we had to do it in 12 days. And
wow.
That's almost impossible when you've got 9 principal actors on horseback, a complete entire Indian village. It was at least 20 different locations within the Valleyzé Movie Ranch. But we lucked out because we were at the Valleyzé Movie Ranch. Everything was self-contained. Had we had to leave the ranch, it would never have happened.
Go ahead, Steve.
I was just going to say, so it was important for us to find a location where it was one-stop shopping.
Yeah.
Well, you invoked so many things that I think are important for filmmakers to listen to it and hear. You talked about the advantage of being digital and using the red, the advantages to post and
yeah.
what you can do to correct and or to push in. You know, you talk about having a shot ratio, even though with digital you can shoot forever, but you've got a time limit in which
yes.
you restricts you from being able to shoot forever. Because some people go, well, it's digital, I can just keep going, and then they run out of time. But you were disciplined, and I think that's the, you know, and realizing, you know, I mean, your crew and your cast and your director and everybody, you know, that in order to get it done on time, you have to stick to the rules. In other words, that you set for yourselves.
And yes,
so,
yeah. I just thought of something because I think it might be something that we might forget to talk about. One of the things that's really important here is that you have a cast and a crew who is used to doing independent films, because you don't have time to babysit everyone, to explain to them why we're two and done, we're moving on. They need to be right in line with the timing and also somewhat ahead of it, i.e. our production designer and our art department, they had to be 2 and 3 scenes ahead of us setting it up so that when we were done with that particular location, they were ready, we were ready to come in and start set up the cameras and start rehearsing there. So it is important that the entire team that you have has that background as well.
And so much of that comes with, you know, pre-production and your first AD, your line producer, your production managers, the idea of scheduling and knowing what to do and where to be putting people, and then having set management, you know, operating efficiently and skillfully to say, okay, you guys go do this, and they all do it while, you know, Nick and you guys are concentrating on something else.
Yes.
I want to say here, because this is a first feature film, and we mentioned before how ambitious an undertaking it was, and now that I listen to you talk more about it, I go, whoa, what an incredible set of circumstances you put yourself into for the first time. And I think that a lot of people out there go, well, hey, wait, this is a low-budget movie, I'm an actor, I'm in the area, I should get a job, or I'm a crew person, I should work this, but they don't necessarily realize that the reason why you pick the professionals that you do, or for what you just said. In other words, there are a lot of actors out there who might be able to act well, but they don't know framing, they don't know about doing a thing in a take or two, and so you can't bring kind of a newbie actor on in a situation like this as much as you might want to.
Yeah.
Or a
and,
newbie
yeah.
crew person. Because you're under the gun. You've got, you know, very critical things that need to happen in a timely fashion.
Absolutely, and also when you're doing work like this where your people are getting squibbed and they're getting shot and they're dying,
right.
or they're galloping full pace on horses with a bunch of horses around you, or shooting guns and you know, so there's various aspects of that even as well for the art of doing an independent, authentic timepiece that's important too. And we were very stringent about that in the casting sessions, about asking the actors who were auditioning, do you have any horseback riding experience? And we don't mean that you went on a horse one time when you were 10 years old for a pleasure ride. We mean, do you know how to ride a horse? And because I'm a horsewoman, when they would say it, I was able to then get into questioning them further, and I could tell whether they were telling me the truth or not.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, you and I talked before about this, and I said, you know, my limit to writing horse and movie was with another horse. I mean, there were two of us in the scenes and the shots writing. But you had as many as 9 people or so riding together and trying to frame that and keep the horses together and keep the actors. Like, I mean, they're the cast members. You're not doubling these people up. They're doing their own riding.
Well, that's right.
So, I mean, amazing, just totally amazing. You guys are out of your mind. You're just
We were really out of, and I'll tell you what, that's with all of everything being perfect, right, Steve? That would be if everything went perfectly, and it didn't.
You'd be amazed at what can happen. And for any young or first-time movie makers out there, that's what you really want to do, is make sure that you're prepared for what you don't even know what's going to happen. And you think of just a simple gallop ride into the village, nothing can go wrong, but your horse can fall into a pothole, can be cut on the horse. Lots of things can go wrong.
Oh, absolutely. My gosh. Well, you know, it could have been a nice little romantic comedy, you know, kind of a coffee scene, you know, a little Clerks kind of thing in a store, you know, but you guys decided to brave the element. Now, you're shooting in 110, 120 degree heat as well.
Exactly. And so you have and that's another aspect, too. When we were talking about shooting quickly, most of this is exteriors, so we're losing light. So that's another factor. We've got, this was a journey movie. So the majority of it is about the danger and the unfolding of what's going to happen, all the bad things that are going to happen to these people once they go on this journey. So there's no way to cheat that. You know, you're outside, you're done for. So you have the blazing heat, you know, everyone's sweating, which was actually great because it looks wonderful on camera. We're really soaked in sweat. You've got bees and hornets that are around us, stinging us and the whole nine yards. And you have to be very careful of the other elements, like the rattlesnakes. This is an 800-acre real movie ranch. And next thing you know, you have to have people going ahead to make sure there's no rattlesnakes. And I saw them. I mean, I saw them.
Yeah.
And there's actually mountain lions there, too. So you have to be thinking ahead.
So, yeah, well, I mean, you know, that is, I wandered off on a set when I was 18, 19 years old, up just in Topanga Canyon alone, up in the mountains. Mm-hmm. And the caretaker on that property when we were shooting, I came, you know, wandering back, you know, while everybody was setting stuff up. I mean, he tore me a new one. He goes, "Do you realize what's in these mountains? There's snakes." He said, "I killed a snake, this morning before you got here under my cabin. I mean, on my trail." I mean, he was like, "You have no idea what you just wandered off into." And I'm like, "Oh, come on, this is a mountain." He's like, no, there's a mountain lion, there are snakes. So, I mean, you guys, I mean, you're dealing with this stuff. I mean, and you've got a whole bunch of people to be responsible for.
Yes. And it's very frightening from the standpoint of being producers on it because, you know, you have all the creative fun stuff that you want to make sure that all of that is handled. But then you have the fears as, you know, it's Steve's money. We're producing this. This is our first baby together. And now we're worried about the safety of everyone as well. And I literally, remember, Steve, I would run around with my little first aid bag. Tell me about that.
She really was playing Dr. Sarah, you know, for every nick and scratch that everybody got. She just was in character the whole time.
We had my prop doctor's bag, and then I literally brought, they would ask for Lenore's second doctor bag, and I brought a whole bunch of stuff for all the cuts and bruises and bee stings. And so in between takes, someone would literally go, you know, "Dr. Sarah, I just got this cut. Can you help me?" And I literally would do that. I would run over and bandage them up, check it out.
It's true. I mean, our director got, you know, attacked by bees, and you know, so she was.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah, it was, and even one time, a bunch of horses. One of the horses got attacked by bees. It was crazy. It's the real Wild West out there, you know, on Daniel Valliere's motion picture ranch. It's not like it's, you know, a replica. It is the Old West, you know, with every element.
And it is located where? Where?
That's in Newhall, California, and it is within the 30-mile range, which was terrific for us.
Okay.
And It's really a magnificent place. I mean, I don't think we can say enough about it. It had the Yellow Rock, the town that we called Yellow Rock. It had my cabin exactly as we had it written in the script. Daniel actually built a mine there. There were so many wonderful locations that are already there, that are sets, that can be used. And then you also got this incredible landscape with mountains and trees and trails, and it is really eye candy, and you don't have anything else around there. I mean, there's nothing. There's no street lights. There's no traffic. You're really out in the Wild West for real.
So did people return to their homes at night? You didn't have to house them. They could just, because you're in studio range. I mean, you're in the 30 mile. So
yeah, most people did. And then as you go along, I mean, we also, by the way, we shot this where we would do 5 days on, 2 days off. So we really tried to give actors as much comfort as we possibly could to take care of them, because we knew that, you know, having them go at a breakneck clip for 6 days and going over 12 hours would just kill everybody. So we kept within the 12 hours, 5 days on, 2 days off. And then as you got along, you start getting more tired. So some of us did start staying up there. There was actually, we had an amazing amount of trailers on set. We had a whole village that was base camp. So
I was
really
how far your base camp was from most of the set. You know,
it was there. Yeah, it was there on the location with, you know, I mean, Michael Biehn and James Russo and myself, we all had our own trailers, beautiful honey wagons that we got a wonderful situation with through Daniel Valuzet and our director, Nick.
Okay.
We had trailers for everyone else. It was a city. It was an actual city there that was base camp.
So I want to do two things. One, you started to take care of that, but I'm going to want to come back to a question here. The stars of the movie are yourself and Michael Biehn and James Russo and
Michael and Eddie Spears.
Michael and Eddie Spears, okay. And we'll talk about other cast in just a moment. But the website, I want to get the website and your Facebook and stuff out right away, because people can watch the trailer if they're not familiar. The trailer's on YouTube. I put it in the chat room. I've got the website in the chat room as well, but I want to make sure that the listeners, if they're listening, can go and find these. So YouTube, they can find the official trailer for Yellow Rock.
Yes, we have an actual YouTube channel, Yellow Rock Movie. Everything is pretty much under Yellow Rock Movie. So Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, it's all under Yellow Rock Movie.
YellowRockMovie.com.
YellowRockMovie.com is the website. And then, of course, for Facebook, it's Facebook.com, Yellow Rock Movie. Twitter is Twitter, Yellow Rock Movie. And YouTube, if they go to YouTube and put in Yellow Rock Movie, our Yellow Rock Movie channel comes up, where we've got behind-the-scenes clips, the trailer, interviews, television, red carpets of premieres that we've had at film festivals. So they can get a lot of great stuff there as well.
That is awesome. And then my question was for the listeners, because you mentioned the 30-mile radius and the studio. Can you elaborate on that, being outside, 35 miles away, you're on location versus being in town, and what that means to production? And
okay.
Maybe Steve, too, in terms of executive producing, what it means, the difference in terms of what you have to do or what you would have had to do and the difference in cost.
Okay. We actually did this as a union film. This was not a non-union film. So this was a SAG film, which we chose to do that in part because we wanted people that had the name value, like a Michael Biehn and James Russo and Michael and Eddie Spears and myself. I'm a SAG actress also. But we wanted to be able to adhere to what those prerequisites were. One of them is the 30-mile range. If you do non-union, it doesn't matter about the 30-mile range. That's up to you, and that's up to you and your cast. But within the SAG guidelines, once you go over the 30-mile range, you do have to house the actors And or you do have to give them a certain amount, a per diem for gas and expenses, and you have to pay them more because they're now on the clock. So it was important to us, since we did want to do this as a SAG film, to make sure that it also didn't hamper us financially to such an extent that it was just crazy and going to kill us on you know, financially. So that actually made a lot more sense to us to do both. So we lucked out. We wanted it to be a real film and one where everybody felt really good about doing it, that they weren't hiding from SAG, that they were very much out in the open and doing a union picture, but yet still make them comfortable.
Wow, cool. Very cool. Can we talk a little bit, yes or no, and the answer is totally up to you, about what the budget was and or how you got the talent? Was it a favored nations clause or I mean, we don't have to go into too much detail, but just how do you assemble a cast and crew, you know, of this caliber?
Okay. Yeah, it was favored nations, and you do have to get the okay from the representatives, whether it's the agent or managers, and of course the actors themselves, when you have stars of this caliber. Then the supporting cast, of course, you know, they have to all agree to it, but yes, this was favored nations. It was a low-budget SAG indie. And I think the reason that that worked for them was because it was a Western. You know, what actor doesn't like to play cowboys and Indians? We did it as children. What a great, fun time to be shooting and galloping on horses and out in the wilderness. And, you know, it's such a fantasy for most people. And we actually heard a statistic that, like, only one out of 10 directors ever gets to possibly even do a Western, let alone actually do it. And most actors don't ever get to do Westerns. So it was a real, as challenging as it was, the actors were up for the challenge and they really wanted to do it. So so we lucked out and were able to do this in a much more affordable way. When it comes to the budget, Steve was mainly our guy. You want to talk about how you started and kept opening your wallet?
Well, I know I said this earlier in the show, Rex, but I'm going to be redundant about it. You cannot be undercapitalized. You can budget your movie, but you also have to make sure that you've got enough on the sidelines, especially for post. Otherwise, movie makers can sit there and their movie's like a tangled ball of Christmas tree lights and they can't get it in the can.
Right.
So anything can and anything probably will go wrong, and you have to kind of think ahead in that regard. But my partner, Lenore, lied to me to start off anyway. I mean, she told me all I was going to do was just, you know, get a chair and sit on set and watch her shoot a movie. That couldn't have been farther from the truth. I was hauling ice back and forth. I'm playing craft services. I'm, you know, it's just amazing what happens on set and what you have to do. 120 degrees out there, it was so grueling that you really do need, and we did fortunately have tremendous cooperation from everybody, cast, crew. I mean, and that's what you have to have on independent films like this, people that know what you're up against and understand it.
Oh, that is, I mean, again, you know, I can't emphasize enough the insanity that you guys have gone through in choosing
Rex,
a Western to be your first, huh?
Yeah, Rex, the backstory to everything is probably more interesting than the movie itself. I mean, it really is an amazing undertaking. There were so many ups and downs behind the scenes that you don't even have enough time on this show to go over it.
Well, we don't, but as we've discussed, we're going to revisit Yellow Rock a number of times with you and potentially Nick, the director, and other people and cast members and things like that. So, because I really do want to explore this, because you know, while most people may not get to direct or act in Westerns, they are hot now and they are of interest, and the challenges that they present. I mean, in other words, if I think a lot of people, especially now, when anyone can pick up a camera and anyone can cut a movie, not that they should, not that they're good at it, but the fact that movie making has become more consumer mode than ever before, that when we can talk about something that's challenging like this and the kind of errors and mistakes that can happen. Hopefully we spare a lot of other people those mistakes when they do make their horror movies and their dramas and their comedies and their, you know, other than Western features or their action films, because they will have learned from the sweat and tears and and through the laughter of what went on, you know, in a production like your production here today that we discussed.
Yes, and
I
really
find it extremely valuable.
It really, we really hope that we can help in that regard, because when people were telling us that we were absolutely insane for trying to do this, they weren't that specific. So, you know, that doesn't really help you. You know what I'm saying? It's
right.
Like, okay, well, we're crazy. We know that for trying to do this, but we needed to know the whys and just sort of the blanket statements of anything can and will happen. When they said that to us, we said, well, okay, but, you know, I've been doing this for a long time as my career. I know that already. But it is good for people to know what the bad and the good is as you're doing the pitfalls that you have to look out for when you're doing a Western. And what we can do, Rex, you were mentioning, you know, you'd like us to talk again, and we'd love that.
Right.
Maybe a little bit further down the line, if folks have watched the movie, then they can actually come to the table with questions that would
right.
be very specific about what they saw, and we're happy to answer those as well.
Well, that's why I told you, you know, I'm just going to watch it again, and I do want to watch it again, but I also want to watch it again now with having spoken more in depth with you about the movie to go, this makes it even more interesting to look at the different things, and it would give me other questions that I would want to ask you, too.
Did you actually see different things in the second and third go-around when you watched the film?
Yeah, I can't specify what that would be
yes.
at this moment, but absolutely. I mean, as a young filmmaker, I always went to movies four or five times of those movies that I really liked, or those movies that I thought there was something to learn from, because I went and I would put on, you know, an actor cap, and then I'd try and come back as a cinematographer cap, and I'd try and come back with a director cap and look at it from different points of view. And I still do that, and so that's kind of where I'm in with Yellow Rock right now. And because of this conversation, it enriches even further. I go back and go, okay, now if I were an actor on this, you know, what do I notice, and what are the challenges? Now, if I were directing something like, so, you know, what if I had to be a gaffer on this, what would I be lighting, and how would it, you know, and that's, or an editor, you know, what would I, but yes, the answer is yes.
Sure, yes.
Absolutely.
Yes, and I'd actually like Steve to actually talk about that, because
yeah, well,
that was purposeful.
Yeah, we purposely wrote it that way, you know, so you can, you know, see more then for yourself in that regard.
There's so, slight layers.
And let's face it, any
oh,
good
yeah,
movie.
Indeed. Yeah, indeed. And story-wise, yeah.
Yeah. And you know those good movies, you want to watch them over and over again, you know, because there's so much more that you can take in. Every time, I don't know how many times I've watched The Unforgiven, and I still catch something, you know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And I think that this is something that is important for people to know, too. When you're doing an independent film, there's going to be mistakes. There's going to be things that, you know, people can watch the movie and go, oh, you know, what about this? Okay, it's an independent film. It wasn't done by Warner Brothers. You know? You're lucky that you got the film done. You know?
I'll be candid right now. I didn't notice any mistakes. That's not that, nothing that way stuck out to me at all. So, and if they're there, maybe I'll find them. But, I mean, I didn't notice.
Well, thank you. And we tried to do the best that we possibly could. And that's one of the magics of editing and in post, believe me,
well,
you know.
And everything does, you know. I mean, it's the kind of thing that I remember watching TV shows where somebody's speeding along at like 70 miles an hour and they cut to the gear shift and they're in park. You know, and I'm like, why did they bother to do that? Why didn't they just not put the gear shift in? I mean, you know, but they did. And I'm like, okay.
You know, it's so important what Lenore mentioned, too. We had a great editor, John Vasquez, and everything that happens in post is so critical. Everybody told me, Michael Biehn and James Russo, do not skimp on things like sound and color and all the things that
right.
would happen
right.
in post. That's where the quality and the production value of your movie, you know, is either there or it's not. And that's where most independent films fall down. They don't have the great sound. You know, they tried to cut, you know, costs in post, and that's not where you cut.
And the music.
And our musical score as well.
A friend of mine, Chris Lockhart, who's been on the show a number of times, actually, recently has a movie coming out called The Collection. And we were chatting one time. I'm sure he wouldn't mind me saying this, but I said, what was the budget? He said, $10 million. I go, my gosh, why is it $10 million when, you know, The Collector was a low-budget movie? He goes, because I want it to look like a movie you would see in a theater.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they put their money, you know, into making, you know, everything look right and appear right so that, you know, when it came out, it was the kind of movie that people were used to seeing. So you're absolutely right. I mean, you can't skip on anything in post. You can't skip on sound, and you can't skip on these. And it doesn't appear, you know, I hope this comes off as the compliment it's intended to be. It doesn't appear that you did any skimping. It doesn't really appear that you've been hampered in any way. It looks like a movie I would go see in a theater. I mean, it looks, you know, what I'm, you know, it's, I like the look of the film from the opening frames.
Go ahead. I was going to say, that's exactly what our intention was. You know, we wanted to make sure that we had something that had that kind of production value in Lenore.
Yeah, when we talked to our producer's rep about this, this was sort of right after wrapping, so to speak. We just sort of had a first cut. We discussed all of this. Okay, well, what is the intention in terms of the platforming of this movie? Is it going to be straight to video? Is it going to be for film festivals / art houses? What do you guys want out of this? And we said, well, you know, we want to really try to give it its due. And, you know, since Steve was all in anyway at this point, we did have a couple of other investors, thank God for them as well. We thought, why skimp on this? Let's try to make it look and sound and feel like a film you would actually go to a theater and see. And if it has any legs in that regard, let's give it that shot and see what happens. And we've been traveling the film festivals around the world with this film and seeing it on the big screen in 7.1 and 5.1 surround sound. It would blow you away, Rex. The difference is amazing.
Oh, cool.
So we have had it theatrically premiering around the world. I just got back from Spain not too long ago from the Almeria Western Film Festival there. You know, and you're just so proud of it. You feel like, you know, I feel like I'm a little kid again watching Westerns on the big screen. It was really an amazing thing. And then it makes it that much easier to then put it into the 4x3 for television and for digital downloads and et cetera. So for us, that worked. And we will be taking it out theatrically in some art houses and Native American casinos and the like as well.
And I don't want to be getting – I'm sorry to interrupt. I didn't want to be getting ahead of this interview here, but one of the big reasons why we're even doing this is the mission statement of our company in the first place. Cool. The message behind our movie was very important for us to tell.
Awesome. Oh, this is very good. I say that we're at that point where I need to take a break right now, but before I take a break, let me ask you, where can people see the movie? How can they get it?
Okay. It is available. It has recently been put out nationwide on several platforms. For Street, it is at Walmart. Most of the time, if you can't find it in the store, you can order it through walmart.com. It's also available through Amazon.com, Blockbuster, Barnes & Noble, Family Video, Ingram. It has been on Video On Demand. I'm not sure if it's still playing nationwide, Video On Demand, but it was on NBC Universal, Verizon, AT&T, most of the Video Online, Video On Demand cable networks. It's also available at Redbox. That was just released the other day nationwide. Which I just got one, actually, the other day. I wanted to see how it looks when it pops out of the red box key, little kiosk there. And it's also available for streaming on iTunes, Sony platform, PS3, and Xbox 360.
Oh, that's very cool. That's very, very cool. So listeners have an opportunity and viewers have an opportunity to see it in many different areas and places. So that's mm-hmm. that's cool. All right, I'm going to take a short break. You guys stand by, and we'll be right back. Listening to Rex Sykes Movie Beat. The official web address is rexsikes.com. That's my name. I'm your host, Rex Sykes. My guests today are Lenore Andriel and Steve Doucette, producers, writer, and actress, actually, of the film Yellow Rock, the movie, the feature film Western, starring Michael Biehn, James Russo, Lenore Andriel, and others. I'll say that for now. All right. So, again, I want to remind everybody who's listening to please leave comments both live during the show and or archive. Doesn't matter when you leave the comments. If you're at the player, you can always go leave a comment. Tell what you liked. Tell if you have questions. Tell what you hated, whatever it might be. But leave a comment at the player either during the show or after the show. Different people's browsers do different things, and the window may or may not be obvious. But it's beneath the chat room if you have the chat room open. During the live. Also, rate and review the podcast at iTunes and subscribe. There's over 300 hours of professional filmmakers sharing their expertise, their secrets, their tips, their how-tos, their golden nuggets, their what to do, what not to do to help you make your films, your movies, your web series, your television shows smoother, less expensively, more efficiently, and to advance your own careers, whether they be in front of the camera or behind the camera. And so we help you do that. We also help and ask that you share this interview and these interviews with your friends and filmmaking friends on Twitter, on Facebook. Your live tweets right now are really good. If you're listening in the chat room, you can tweet some of these comments that my guests make live. That's very valuable to us. Whenever you promote my guests, you promote me. I really do appreciate it, and I thank you for all the love. So, again, we're back with Lenore and Steve, and thanks for hanging in there. Wow. So we have come to a point where we've literally got about 20 minutes left in the show. And let me ask you about your director. And then, I want to, before we do that, let's go to the mission of Enlightenment Films.
Yes. When I initially started Enlightenment Films, it was because as an actor, I didn't feel that I was always necessarily able to get the best roles and the best scripts and et cetera. You have to make a living. And
right.
Though I was always thankful for any work, I felt that I was, you know, I'm an adult now and I want to be doing work that I felt very proud of and would leave my mark somehow through my acting work. So I developed Enlightenment Films to be able to, whether it was writing projects myself or potentially buying scripts from other people that would have some sort of an impact, touch people in some way, maybe raise their level of consciousness or were informative. And so then when Steve joined on with that, I was developing projects, but when he really joined on, he had the same exact intent, and we thought, this is really what we want to do. We're not here to make just movies about nothing and hope that we make a lot of money. We want to actually, and that's okay. That's totally fine. It just wasn't our mission. Our mission was to have movies that hopefully impart something to make people think. And give them something that they walk away from the film and say, you know, that impacted me in some way.
Well, I also, and I think you're accomplishing that, and I also found with the movie, and I don't want to give anything away story-wise or plot-wise, but say that I found that there were interesting twists in there, and what I thought was going on may not have been going on, and when things were revealed, then I go, oh, now this is interesting. It's truly, you know, about this as opposed to that, you know. And
yes.
You know, so
yes.
That why these things occurred was out of, you know, whatever basic human, you know.
Yes. We like to leave, we thought that when we were writing this together, that we would try and leave things like the ending up to your own interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
as far as what the audience, what do you think happened? So it has that type of an ending to it as well.
Yeah.
But our goal from day one, any projects that we have, is to entertain and to enlighten.
Very cool. Well, and I think one, it's noble, and two, you accomplished it. I always tell filmmakers, myself included, I go, you know, we all have crap in our backgrounds, things that we're not pleased with, but everybody's got it, you know, and everybody's done it, you know, and hopefully you get to leave, you know, a better legacy of things that you're proud of. And I got to say, you know, for this being your first movie out of the gate, you can be real proud of it.
Thank you. Well, you know, it's always hard, Rex, and I really do appreciate you saying all the wonderful things that you're speaking from your heart. You know, you make a movie, and someone had said this to me, and it's really true. There's a movie that you write, the movie that you shoot, and the movie that you wind up having. And I never realized the import of that and how true it is as well. And though it's the same movie, certainly in theory and et cetera, there are different things that wind up happening to it. It's like watching a child grow. And so, of course, you love the baby. I mean, we love our baby, and we've watched it a billion and one times, of course, and you're sitting in post and watching it and tweaking and et cetera. But then you have to put the baby out there in the world. You have to put that child out there and see how everyone responds to it. And, you know, of course, not every movie is going to be for everyone. And if people are just looking for something that's your more standardized shoot 'em up Western, that's not this. Though there's tons of shooting, this does have many layers to it and mysticism and a message, et cetera. And we've been very fortunate because going to the film festivals and seeing the audience's reactions and the Q&As and et cetera afterwards, it's being so wonderfully embraced. The feelings that you have about it are coming through, but whether it's other reviewers, et cetera, and audiences, it's the same, and we're very fortunate about that. And then we've also, we're up to 18 awards on this film.
Wow.
So
wow.
We have the medal as well. It's sitting on our tables. So
true.
That makes you very proud, you know, when you have those awards sitting there and you go, well, it's not just us, you know, being very proud of our child. Other people are appreciating what we try to accomplish here.
Well, and that's very, very cool. It goes back to, you know, me saying, when you listen to you talk and when people hear what you did in terms of writing and producing and acting in this,
mm-hmm.
and executive producing and you know, but assembling the team that you did and doing it in 12 days, you know, I mean, it's just. You know, it's just amazing. I was going to say, it's just mind-boggling. How long was pre-production?
Now, that was actually something I was going to touch on before. We were talking about that before, and I thought, you know, this is a good time to talk about that. The pre-production was paramount to being able to shoot that in 12 days. We did pre-production for a good 3 months. Part of it was that at one point, Nick Vallelonga, actually brought to the table Michael Biehn and James Russo, who he had worked with on several other films. Paul Weber cast the Cowboys, and he's a wonderful casting director. We're going to use him for the rest of our lives if possible. he closed all those deals. But when Nick brought us the possibility of Michael Biehn, who wanted to read it first, of course, he was actually doing The Victim. He and his wife, Jennifer, were doing their film, The Victim, which they wrote and produced and acted in. So we had to actually postpone a little bit more in the end to actually wait for him. But that was a great service for us because it gave us that much more time to be so specific about breaking everything down and the costumes and all the minutia, the guns, the saddlery, the actors being, myself included, being trained on movie horses versus just horseback riding. And that was really paramount to being able to try to pull that off in 12 days. So we wouldn't recommend 2 weeks pre-production and then go try to shoot the movie in less than 2 weeks.
No.
Oh, geez. Well, no, I'm sorry. I don't want to cut you off, Steve. But I just wanted to say there is a difference. There's a huge difference between riding a movie horse and riding
mm-hmm.
a horse.
Yes, there is. And I can certainly speak to that. From the time I was 9 years old, I've been around horses and was always a pleasure rider. I know how to ride English and Western. But then Steve and I decided, because I was not going to have a stunt double, I was insisting on doing all my own riding, that I actually then work with the trainer to work with the actual riding for a movie. I mean, when you're riding and you have to deliver dialogue and you have to interact with the other actors and they're on horses, keep in frame, hit your mark, go back to one, keep your horse in control at the same time that you're very aware of the camera, your co-actor, and the lines that you're supposed to be delivering. Those are all very, very, very specific things that you have to do. And there was one time, actually, that I took Clay Wilcox, who played Roscoe in the film. He had worked in Deadwood and had gone to cowboy school, like, for about 3 weeks. And I said, well, Clay, let's go to the stables that I'm training at. I was training at the LA Equestrian Center. And we'll work with my trainer, you know, and because you're going to have a lot of different hard riding that you're going to have to learn how to do. We went, we were riding, we started to, my trainer said, okay, we're going to gallop up this mountain and around that bend. And we did, and my horse was on the left of Clay's. His horse kicked my horse right in the left hind quarter, and we were falling off the cliff.
Oh, geez.
And I righted my horse just on instincts, thank God, between that and what she had trained me. I was able to put all my weight on my right stirrup, pull the horse back with the to the side with the reins, and shift him back up onto the mountain and speed off and gallop, kick him off and gallop up ahead. But my horse was bleeding. So, you know, this was just in training, you know, because poor Clay, you know, he was not used to this horse. His horse really got angry that my horse was coming around to the left. You never know what's going to happen. So thank God we did all that work ahead of time. So we were trying to avert anything that could happen on the trail. But we also had one of the top wranglers in the business, Kevin McNiven. He owned all 17 horses that he brought to the set. With Artisher Radpour, his main assistant wrangler, and they did an enormously wonderful job wrangling. As soon as there was any problems, they were immediately right there, were able to get the horses in control, told us ahead of time what we could not do. You have to shoot the gun over the middle of the head of the horse because they shy if it goes to the right or left because they see from the side. So you have to be very careful. If it's going over the middle of their head, they're okay with it. And these were movie horses.
Right.
But even as movie horses, you have to be very careful with what they're actors in the film. Those horses are actors the film. And you have to work within their boundaries and what they are accustomed to as well. And you can't let them my horse was a muncher. He was a beautiful Palomino named Hustler. And he loved to munch in between takes. And you can't let him do it because then he slows down. Then he gets nice and full and he's getting lazy and he doesn't want to do his work, you know. So there's a lot of aspects. Even if people do know how to ride horses, they still should be training on movie horses as well and work with them before you do a Western.
Well, one of the things that I had gone through training like this years and years ago, but I was going to say one of the things that they had impressed on us was that movie horses have so much. They may have so many subtle commands, like if you lay the reins to the left or to the right, you know, over there. They have a lot of different commands. So it takes an experienced rider to be able to ride them without confusing the horse, because you could be giving a command by leaning your weight to one way and putting the reins in another way. That might be a command for them to do something.
Yes.
That, you know, and so if you just hop on a movie horse and start riding off, you may end up going nowhere.
It's so true.
Anywhere other than what you wanted to do. Because the horse doesn't
end up
know
on somebody else's set. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Because you are inadvertently signaling the horse to do things, and when you're trying to adjust, you may be continuing to signal in different ways. So
yes.
learning how to ride that horse is a huge, huge thing.
I'll tell you, just working with animals in a movie is can be very, very interesting. I think is probably the word to use. You know, we had wolves, and at one point before we started this movie, we were actually considering and grizzly bears that we were going to be doing the movie with. So, Lenore, maybe you can tell us a little bit about that.
I'd have herded wild squirrels. You know, I mean.
Well, you know, one of the wonderful things about shooting at Bayouzet was that there was actually, you know, you get to use all those real birds and the hawks and the owls and the sounds of the turkey vultures flying overhead, so, and the ravens. So that was a great thing because that added a whole, and the bugs, even the bees buzzing, you know, and the wind, all of those aspects were used in the movie, and that's another great topic that we won't get into. Today we don't have time, but the sound design of this movie was heavy duty and beautifully done by Monkeyland Audio, and I'd love to talk about that another time. But we also had the wolves, as Steve said, and I think you'll agree, Rex, they were quite beautiful in the film, weren't they?
Oh, of course. Yes, absolutely.
But there, you have to work very specifically with them as well, and I'm more than happy to talk about it, or if we're out of time, I mean, you tell me.
Well, let's do this, I'll let the listeners know right now that we're going to have you and Steve back at another time. We also have another show coming up in 2 days on Thursday, which is, what, the 6th of December?
Mm-hmm.
I don't normally give out dates, but it's relevant at this point. So same time, same place, same, you know, Rex Sykes Movie Beat location. We're going to have some guests come back, possibly the director and and
other executive producer.
Okay, so and they'll be coming back on the show and we'll be talking too. So, but we will continue. Let's save that for a second because I do want to ask you about how Nick got involved. He's your director and because you mentioned he brought Michael and James to the table, and then about the ranch and the gentleman who became the other producer.
Yes, Nick and I actually met as actors on a movie set in New York years ago when we were doing extra work. And it's such a long, you know, when I think about it, you know, and here we are, we've done this film now, and he directed it, and I did the female lead. It's such a long, far cry from where we started. And we became great friends in New York. We started working together as actors. I had a little murder mystery company out there that actually did quite well. And he became our detective in the murder mystery and that I would perform in. And so we became great friends. One day we were sitting on the beach taking a break from doing the murder mystery, and he said, you know, I'm going to go out to L.A., and I think you should do the same. And we had a long talk about it, and I said, well, you go out there, you tell me what you think it's like. He did. He said, he raved about it. He said, Lenore, you have to get out here. This is where you should be. I did come out. We stayed friends here. And, you know, periodically he would get busy, I would get busy. And we went to do this project, and I had another producing partner who then got, because I'd never produced a film before, he then got another project, and I was left to do this by myself, and it, literally throwing myself into the deep end of the pool, learning and doing as I was going. And as I'm writing as well and getting prepared to do the female lead. So about 3 weeks before we were supposed to start, I called Nick to see if there was another producer that maybe could help me. And he said, I'll do it. I would love to do it. I'd love to work with you. We had a director. We started shooting the film, and 3 days into it, this director, it was very overwhelming, very difficult, and we decided, you know what, the best thing is really for Nick to take over as director, since he had both backgrounds, both producer and director backgrounds, and he knew the cast very intimately, so it was going to be a lot more easy for him to work with them and work with the constraints that Westerns have. And it was a whole different style of directing. Nick is a very out front, very vociferous director. And we needed that. We really did need that. We needed to get everything working like clockwork and everybody really a heavy hand coming in and being playing good cop, bad cop. I can only play good cop.
You know, it's very difficult, you know, when because she's the writer and trying to produce and then, you know, trying to act. And it's hard to let go of that and even give those controls over to anybody.
Yeah.
It just is. It's her baby. So Nick was more than competent at coming in and making sure that, you know, we just, you know, shot the film and we got the movie in the can. So that was he was a godsend to us in that regard. He
mm-hmm.
really was.
Yep.
We have an old history together. Had he ever done a Western before that?
No. He had never done a Western either. The only ones, there was very few people on the film that had done a Western. Michael Biehn, Russo, and the Spears brothers, and Daniel Valuzzi, of course, that's the majority of what he's done is Westerns, and Peter Schirico, who played Farley. Remember him, Rex, he has the cigar in his mouth the whole time?
Of course.
And he, not only did he play Farley, but he provided us, through his company, Caravan West, with all the movie horses, all the saddlery, the artillery, the costumes, the props, the set designer, the production designer, and the art department. So he was a huge godsend, and he came
to... Go ahead.
Yeah, we actually got him through Katie Elhoffer, our costume designer. She said to me, and I love her, and I'm sure you'll be talking to her as well. She said, you know, you should talk to Peter Schirico. And she said, I just did a small Western with him, and he has everything you need. And I went, oh, my God. And we had the role of Farley, too. And he said, well, you know, I'd love to play that role. And we went, you got it. You're perfect.
He was great.
He was great.
When you meet Peter Schirico, I mean, he is a real cowboy. And you just don't make Westerns without him. It's that simple. You know, he outfitted Tombstone, too, I believe.
Oh, really? Well, that's very cool. Now, you know, one of the things that I'll just point out as an aside for the listener, and that is, again, if this goes back to kind of it's who you know and who knows you. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, people often think, well, I break in, I do this, and you know, I'm of value, but you know, it's your customer says, hey, I know this guy, you know, and you know, I mean, it's like anything else, you know, it's a business, and it's a business based on trust and referrals, and sometimes things don't work out. But I mean, people, you said, I'll use Paul Weber. Paul is a friend, and he's been on my show a number of times. I even brought him into Milwaukee to do a casting workshop for actors here.
Wonderful.
So that they could have experience meeting somebody who's a professional in the business and you know what they're looking for. You know, and you know, he's incredible. But I mean, you know, you said earlier, you said, well, I would work with Paul on everything. And that's what I think a lot of filmmakers trying to break in don't understand. It's not because people want to exclude anyone.
Yes.
It's because they found an inclusive team that they bind because they know and trust and value each other's work and their experience and their reputations. And so these little clicks happen, and it's not to trying to keep anybody out, but it is hard to get in. Because
Yes. I worked actually with Martin Scorsese and Woody Allen. I had the honor of working with both of them. I was in Goodfellas and Crimes and Misdemeanors. And both of them, as directors, that's what they do. They, from Woody Allen hires the same casting director. You know, Scorsese almost always works with De Niro. I mean, those are just very small examples, but they're
sure.
teams there. Exactly right. And as an actor, I always felt on the outside saying, oh, well, same thing that you're talking about. How do you get in? Well, being on the other side now, I totally understand that because our money and our lives are based on those people knowing what they're doing. And that trust level, it's enormously important to making the film the right way.
And you do. You gravitate towards the kind of people that you want to work with. Lenore comes from a stage training background doing off-Broadway. You know, not everybody does that. You know, some people can't do stage work. And so I think that, you know, because she did this with Nick, that there was a natural gravitation towards each other, and as well as some other people like James Russo, who did a lot of, you know, stage work himself.
Well, you know, it's an amazing thing because, Lenore, you and I were talking about this, when you shift from an actor to the other side. I should say we were talking about this at another time so people don't sit there and go, when did they say that?
That's true.
Maybe I'm hallucinating. But we were talking about when you shift from being an actor to being behind camera, you understand how the actor does or doesn't fit into everything. And when you're just the actor, you tend to think, well, this is my shot. This is the difference between paying my rent or not paying my rent, or this is my moment to shine, and you know, my career will launch from here. You may not have an understanding of how you fit into it as a team player or the value of your character or the role or the story as much as the director or the producers, the people who are looking at the big picture.
Yes,
so,
yes. Yeah, yes, that was a good conversation that we were having. I remember that. It's definitely something that I think all actors should actually just, even if they assisted a casting director at the very least on a casting session, would see that it's not about them. And that's really where actors, where we all come from. We think it's about us, but it's not. It's about the tapestry that is trying to be created through the casting director, the writer, the producers. They have a vision. And either you're going to fit that vision perfectly and be the answer to their prayers, or you're terrific, but you just don't happen to fit that color of thread that we were looking for. And it has nothing to do with them. It has nothing to do with you as the actor. And it really helped me to sit in on those casting sessions. We had two casting directors. We had Bridget Burdeen, who cast all of the Native American roles. And again, you're right. She was a dear friend of mine. I met her through doing voiceovers. And she had wonderful connections with the Native American community, and she cast the Native Americans. And Paul did all the cowboys and the male leads. So I sat in those sessions, and I would see these actors that were terrific, and we'd all look at each other when they walked out, and we'd say, you know, he's perfect, but he looks just like the other guy that we have in mind for the other role. Can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't realize that it could be something so subtle as that. And it really would help actors a lot if they did that, at the very least. Or go work on a film. Be a PA for a day or two. Just be a PA for a day or two and see what the other side is like, and what the directors and producers are going through. So it really is about the big picture. It's not about those specific actors. Maybe they wind up on the cutting room floor. It has nothing to do with their performance. It has to do with it's not working in the story.
Right. And we were so lucky in casting, because really our entire cast just fit exactly the way we envisioned it when we were writing it.
Yeah.
We just didn't dream that we could get somebody like Michael and Eddie Spears. We didn't have any idea that we could get, you know, James Russo and Michael Biehn in our movie. You know, Eddie Spears is now one of the stars of Hell on Wheels, which is a real popular show on TV that got picked up again. Michael has been in a lot of stuff. He was in Dances with Wolves. I think he played, what was it, Otter?
He played Otter, yeah, Michael Spears,
Otter.
Yeah.
So, you know, we had the hots for these guys. They were on a wish list, you know. And because of Bridget, we were able to get those people. And that's great when you see it all coming together as the writers, you know, when you see these people filling in the roles. And they all fit their roles perfectly, I think.
Oh, that's very cool. And that's got to be a great feeling when you see it come alive, you know, and you go, this is cool.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, because we have, you know, maybe about 10 minutes or so left here, and we've got so much more to talk about, and we will, and I want Steve and you to come back and chat more at other times.
We'd love to.
But I want to ask both of you, but Steve, I want to ask you first. As executive producer, because I think there are a lot of people, like I said before, you know, they pick up a camera, they pull together their friends, they make, and that should be a clue right off the bat. If you pull together your friends to make your first movie, think about when you're making your 50th movie, you're still pulling together your friends. you're pulling together those people who you've developed relationships, who you trust, and, you know, because there's a whole lot on the line, especially when there are dollars being spent versus a no-budget movie. Then there's a lot on the line, but it's not necessarily the dollars. But the idea, I have the question, but I'm going to make a statement first. Because you mentioned being a PA or doing casting sessions, and I think this is absolutely crucial for people. If you can, even if there's no pay, if you can volunteer, you get yourself onto a movie set and you work, as Lenore suggested, as Steve will suggest, you know, these positions, and find out what everybody does, find out how they do it, find out maybe why they do it, but work it and see how everything comes together, and make yourself absolutely valuable to everyone there without being a pest and without being, you know, standing out and creating trouble. Add value to them, and you may find that you get a paying job the next time, but also that will, I mean, that education alone is worth far more than you could ever imagine.
Yes.
Now, to Steve and to Lenore, first-time filmmakers or early filmmakers, as an executive producer, what advice do you give to people who are saying, you know, I want to go make a movie? And then Lenore, I mean, you're a producer and an actor, so the same question is there for you as well.
Well, first of all, exposure, which is what you were talking about, is something that I learned when I was doing stand-up comedy. So for people that want to get into this industry, expect to do that. Expect to get out there and work for free sometimes and get yourself out there. I mean, it's all about networking, and it is a who knows you or who do you know business. It's just that simple. So it's great when you're getting your friends together, but when things start getting really serious and everything starts stepping up, as was the case with our movie, you know, you're not looking at friends, you're looking for experienced people. We were fortunate that Lenore just happens to have been in this industry long enough to know those experienced people to fall back on. So we got lucky in that regard. I, as an executive producer, relied on my partner, Lenore Andrell, and her vast, you know, experience and knowledge of the industry itself to pull us through this. So, yes, my advice is make sure you have somebody that really knows what they're doing. And I'm going to say it again, don't be undercapitalized, because that's critical. There's going to be something that's going to happen, you know. And then if you're going to sit there with a movie and post that you can't get sold. So it's critical to make sure that you have, you know, enough funding for your movie and for the mistakes that are going to happen. You don't know what they're going to be, but they're going to happen, and you have to prepare for that. So for filmmakers, don't, you know, be prepared. You can't be prepared enough.
Like pre-production.
Yeah, you just can't. You know, there's a story behind every single scene that we shot.
I bet there is.
It's really amazing. Again, we could make a movie about the making of this. You know, it should be a documentary or something. You cannot go to school for what we did.
Yeah, and I think, actually, that's an interesting point that Steve just made. If I had to, there's so many things, of course, that we would do differently now, but and many of the things that we did do correctly that we would do again. One of the things that I would do is I would have our editor there on set, and at the end of the day, and we did not do this, and at the end of the day, when the DIT guys get done downloading that all those shots from that day, all that raw footage, have it handed off to the editor, who can then run and start working on a first initial assembly, because it not only does that help in terms of getting the film done quicker, but you also get to see we didn't even have time to look at dailies at the end of the day, so he could actually be your other set of eyes looking and saying, you know what, guys, you're missing the coverage on this or that, or that shot it never came out. You need to either do it again, or you need to make some sort of an adjustment, whatever the case is. So you can't have enough safety valves while you're on set, whether it's literally safety or whether it's the safety of the film and how the film is progressing. I would also have iPads on set next time so that we can, after each scene, we could actually see right then and there and go, okay, you know what, we're done, let's move on. Because sometimes you think you're done and you actually maybe forgot to get so-and-so's hand reaching for their gun as an insert. And now on film, it's like, well, where did that come from? So there's many aspects that you can do to sort of cover yourself. Also, in terms of behind-the-scenes footage, we did have Keith Clark shooting behind the scenes. But frankly, I would have had an even bigger crew doing that because it's very tough to get the interviews. We're all shooting. The poor guy was pulling his hair out. He couldn't get enough interviews because all the main cast was shooting most of the time. So, you know, I would make sure that I had enough coverage both in photography. There was never enough shots that were done because you need those for publicity and promotion later on and websites and using that those tools. You know, we're in a digital age. You need to be able to promote after the film is done, and you need all of that footage and those stills and video clips and anything you can gather that help people to see behind the scenes and what it was like.
That's much awesome. That is truly awesome.
I was going to say, some smart directors like Nick Vallelonga, ours, would keep the camera either rolling after the shot or make sure that you're filming the rehearsals, especially when you're doing low-budget movies. A lot of times your actors get it, you know, better in the rehearsal than they did when the cameras were, you know, when everybody was ready to go. So there's lots of tricks to the trade where you can really save yourself, you know, but the biggest thing is just being prepared.
Wow, that's very cool. That is very cool. You know, I miscalculated our time. We actually have a few more moments than I thought, so if you've prepared to wind down, we can actually continue a little bit.
Sure.
We have lots of stories.
That is great advice. That is truly, truly great advice. Let me ask the question about Daniel Valuzet.
Valuzet, mm-hmm.
And how you ended up at the Valuzet Ranch and how he ended up becoming involved as the exec as a EP.
I'm going to let Lenore talk about Daniel. They have struck up an amazing friendship. You're going to have a chance to, and your listeners will have a chance to listen to Daniel, who's done over 300 movies. He's one of the most fascinating guys I've ever met in my life.
And
never at a loss for anything to say. You know, gazillion stories to tell you. But why don't you tell us, Lenore, how it all came about with Daniel?
We were looking for we assumed that we were going to have to shoot this movie in a couple of different locations. You know, it's just the Wild West. You know, we're assuming we're not going to get one-stop shopping, but that would have been the dream. And Ricardo Gale, who was actually one of our DPs, the other one was Matt Garrett and Kenneth Young, but he was one of our main ones. He actually suggested the Valuzet Movie Ranch. We had been location scouting all over the place, and we're not finding the right one. He finally recommended that. We went there, and I thought I entered heaven. This was the perfect location. It had everything we wanted. Actually, the town of Yellow Rock was not in the script initially. And as soon as we got there and saw this fantastic, old, dirty, dusty, gritty town, he actually turned to me, Ricardo, and said, oh, rewrite. And I went, yeah, you bet. And we're definitely going to get the value out of this. And so Steve and I decided absolutely that that would be the town of Yellow Rock. And once we talked to Daniel and found everything perfectly and this was the place, he said, you know what, let me, before I say yes to you renting the ranch, I have to read the script. And he read it and he called back and he said, I absolutely love this. It has so much to it. I love the message of this film. I want to be involved. You absolutely can shoot here and I think I can help you. And we said, oh my God, yes, please, we need help. So he came on as another executive producer with the ranch. And he then wound up becoming one of our main onset producers because once it became the trickle-down theory, you know, once the initial director was gone, Nick then moved from producer to director. Right. I, of course, as producer, had to move in front of the camera as Dr. Sarah. So that left poor Steve, first film, out of the gate, having to be executive producer along with co-executive producer Anthony Lawrence, neither of which had done a Western or done a film. So Daniel became also then our on-set producer. He was a godsend. I mean, I would literally be standing there, you know, we just got done being getting blood on me, and now I have to turn and sign a check. You know? And Daniel was running everything and showing Steve and Tony, and they were helping him, and he was helping them. So it created a wonderful nucleus where then Nick and I as producers could keep popping in, and of course they kept running up to us at, with the next emergency that we all always had to deal with. And it worked out to be a very symbiotic relationship. He also wound up doing second unit direction and got a lot of those wonderful insert shots. And there's a scene in the movie that I defy anyone to find that was actually a pickup shot that Daniel did. And we can talk about it next go around after people have watched it, but it's a really fun bit of trivia. So that's...
You're defying them to find what essentially was a pickup shot?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. It is so masterful.
When it was picked up later, outside of the principal photography.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Right. After you look at
for the listeners. Right.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was going to say after you've watched your movie, you know, and obviously you want to try and do this while you're on set.
Right.
And
right.
Say, hey, we need to reshoot this scene, or we didn't get this, or we didn't get that, and so sometimes, and again, this is where you have to leave yourself, you know, some extra capital to go back if you need to and do some pickup
right.
shots. It can be very simple. It can be something that just allows your movie to breathe a little bit more. It can be very simple. And sometimes it can be complex, whatever it is that you want to do. But we had
go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say we had to do that ourselves, and I think that Daniel pulled it off flawlessly.
Yeah, he did.
And that's a tribute to our editor, John Vasquez, as well.
Right. What were you going to say, Rick?
Very cool. I was just going to say that also goes back to your point of having an on-set editor, because if they can look at it while you're still on set and know, hey, you need this,
yeah,
or you know, you flapped your eye lines or something, or, you know, you can do. Hopefully, you can still incorporate it while you're there.
That's right.
But this sounds awesome. The fact that you were able to go back after the fact and still get a pickup and sit there and go, I defy you to tell, you know, us which it is. That's cool.
Which is also a credit to Daniel, too, because if you were at a different location, we might not have been able to do that. But thankfully, because it was all at the Valley's End Movie Ranch, Daniel said, you know, I will make sure that we can, when you guys need to and are ready, I'll make sure that we were able to go back and get those pickup shots that we needed, and he did a great job in second unit directing that.
Well, that is awesome. Well, let me say this right now. It is yellowrockmovie.com. Yellowrockmovie.com. It's yellowrockmovie on Twitter. It's yellowrockmovie on Facebook. And Lenore and Steve, you're both on Facebook. And
yes,
there's yellowrock. Is it yellowrockmovie on YouTube? Is that the same
yes.
channel?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So there's yellowrockmovie on YouTube. So there's lots for people who are listening right now live or archived to go and look at and read and join and listen and do all of that sort of thing. I want to make sure that we got that in there. Also, we're going to have Lenore and Steve back. We'll also have conversations with others coming up. Next conversation we're going to have about Yellow Rock is this coming Thursday, December 6th. If you guys who are listening right now live or archived would do me the favor and tweet that and use the link, you know, to promote it. That would be fantastic. Put it out there. Put it on Facebook. Put it on Twitter. Share it with your friends. Let them know to listen then as well. If you can't listen live, obviously you can always listen archived, and that's the value of the podcast too. So share that. Leave comments before we go from the show, and tweet about this interview and Facebook. I really would appreciate that. Well, we're going to talk about a lot of different things. I mean, we can talk with the costumer and different people who are on the shoot. Love to talk to the editor. Love to talk about post publicity and marketing and the festival runs that you've done as well, and be able to cover that. So I just want our listeners to know there's a lot. The opportunity for Lenore and Steve that have presented the listeners of Movie Beat to in-depth discuss the making and tracking of Yellow Rock is, I think, just absolutely wonderful and astounding, and we get to talk to people who are in the trenches doing it and what you've done and continue to do. So thank you very much for that. I appreciate that greatly.
Oh, thank you, Rex. This is really enjoyable. We love being a part of your show today.
Me too.
Our pleasure.
Me too. Yeah, no, you bet. Well, you have brought a lot of value to the show and a lot of value to my listeners in this about 80 minutes or 85 minutes of conversation. We are going to have to close it out now. I'm going to leave you both have the last word. The listeners will know that you're coming back, and you and I will talk in just a moment once the show wraps. But go ahead, whatever you'd like to leave people with, and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Rex. Yes, I would love for the listeners, if they get the opportunity to get the film at Walmart or Redbox, Amazon.com, all the, and it's also listed on our website and Facebook pages. I invite them to look at the film and write some questions down, because I really think that we're more than happy to sit here and give our time and share and give back to the film community, both as actors and writers and producers. To really help them, because your show is really invaluable to people, and I really applaud you, Rex. I think it's great what you do, and I wish that Steve and I had actually known you then, because I would have loved to have gotten some heads up before we did ours, but we're certainly here to share and give back with the experiences that we had that hopefully people can gain from. So we are honored to be here.
And we're also now getting very involved in the Native American culture, which is a beautiful culture. And I want the whole world to know this. And their stories are extremely compelling, and we'd like to do it again.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, very cool. So I want to say thank you very much. I was going to ask a question, but I realized we're out of time.
Okay.
But thank you very much. We will have a reprise very shortly.
We look forward to it.
And I look forward to it. Thank you so much, and have a fabulous rest of the day. This has been a fascinating conversation with two very fascinating and incredible filmmakers. I appreciate it so much. Thank you.
Thank you, Rex. Thank you.
All right, and we will talk very shortly.
You got it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, that was my guests, Lenore Andriel and Steve Doucette, producer, writer, actor for Lenore, executive producer, and everything else behind the scenes with Steve. I mean, they both, you know, I mean, when you make a movie, those of you who have certainly know that though you may wear one hat, oftentimes you're called on to do many, 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 many other things and wear many other hats, and certainly that applies here. And I want to talk to Lenore in the future about how she did so and how Steve did so and how the people with, you know, what is it like to write and produce and act all at the same time, you know, or and be able to give up. Because one, if you're the producer, you have to give up control to be the actor. You know, somebody else has to step in, as they were talking about. So there's so many things that we can talk about. Take an opportunity, and I really do. You can join us in the chat room and ask questions the next time. You can email me the questions. Go to RexSykes.com. Go to the contact page. It'll have my email address. There's a thing up there that says questions in advance. If you've got questions that you want to ask of this guest or about the movie, even if we have other guests, you can ask questions. We'll be happy to ask them on the air. And any questions you have in the chat room, you know, we can ask too during that time. So if you can, and you will, take advantage of that. Do leave comments. Do rate and review the podcast. And thanks so much for joining us and for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter as well. It's Rex Sykes Movie BT. It's Rex Sykes Movie BT on Twitter. I love it when you do that and when you share that. And Rex Sykes Movie Beat on Facebook. It's actually Rex Sykes Movie Beat Friends on Facebook. my profile's to the max. I can't, you know, get people onto my profile, but you can join us at Rex Ike's Movie Beat, and please do. I want to thank again Lenore and Steve, and we got many more exciting guests coming up in the near future as well. Other guests besides Yellow Rock, and certainly all of the fascinating people that participated in Yellow Rock. So be sure to stay tuned, and please keep sharing this website and these interviews with all of your friends and your contacts. We do appreciate that. And everybody, I hope you have a fabulous day. Make your movies, complete your projects, and until we meet the next time, that's a wrap.